Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Start off by looking a bit at Nazi geopolitics, and then we're going to move on to the very different instance of American ones. Now, I don't want to repeat what I've already written in my book, Geopolitics and the Quest for Dominance, which came out some years ago, but is still in print, and which actually does discuss the geopolitics both of Weimar Germany in the 1920s and of Nazi Germany in the 30s and early 40s. But there are one or two points that are pertinent. First of all, it's all too often that people, as it were, sink geopolitics to a small number of texts or a small number of individuals, just as they do with strategy. So listeners may be aware that Graham and I have discussed strategy in previous programs, and we've been fairly skeptical about Clausewitz, and we've discussed a number of other strategic figures. But the key point here is that strategy is much broader than the commentators who tend to be focused on, whether it's Clausewitz and Jomini, whether it's Corbett, whether it's Sun Tzu, and, you know, one can extend that list. And that in a sense, it's often, now one has to be cautious here because one doesn't want to be overly rude, but it's often a rather slipshod method to argue that by focusing on a small number of individuals, one's explained either the strategy of a given country or of a given period of time, or indeed of a given type. And the same is obviously true for other subjects. And, you know, with political thought, for example, there is only so much that is to be gained by focusing on Aristotle and Plato or Hobbes or Marx, as opposed to many other thinkers who were more active and many of whom were more consequential, often the people that had time to write these texts. The very reason they had time to write the texts is that they weren't actually figures of much consequence, nor were their subsequent commentators much consequence. Now, in the case of geopolitics, they tend to be people that are slightly more active or prominent. We've already discussed Mackinder, who, of course, rose to be a member of parliament and to try and influence the government and be given a number of official posts. I've already mentioned the early German and Swedish geopoliticians, the Swedish individual whose name I can't pronounce, who was a member of the Swedish parliament. And indeed, if we look at Germany, the key German figure is Haushofer, 1869 to 1946, who, you know, as is often discussed, he had military career early on, including being a military advisor in Japan from 1908 to 1910. He saw active service in World War I. He founded, after the war, the Institute of Geopolitics and led a group of geopoliticians at Munich. And his favorite pupil was Rudolf Hess. And in 1934, Hess appointed Haushofer as president of a council for those of German origins living outside Germany. And for a while, Haushofer was president of the Association of Workers in Geopolitics. And indeed, in 1939, he received the Order of the Eagle of the German Reich from Hitler in recognition of his services to geopolitics. So, you know, self-evidently, he was a figure of significance. He was a figure of importance. And indeed, in World War II, as I comment in my book, the Americans devoted some time to presenting him as the, as it were, intellectual figure behind Lebensraum and geopolitics of the Nazi Reich. Well, the problem with that argument is, without in any way trying to denigrate Haushofer, just as I tried not to denigrate Mackinder, actually, people are putting too much significance on them. Geopolitics did not depend theoretical writers of the whether holding practical positions or not of the early 20th century. One can think, for example, of that standard British trope, the route to India, and all the variants that are played on that in, for example, the successive Balkan crises, such as that of 1878, for example, or indeed 1914, you might argue, in which you did not need a language of formal intellectual propositions in order to have the idea that an increase in Russian power in Southwest Asia and in the Balkans would, it was possibly the case, challenge British interests on the route to India. And I've already mentioned that argument was taken about the Berlin-Baghdad railway, whether it was held by the Germans or indeed sold to the Russians. So you don't need that. And the same is true, of course, for Haushofer. Many of the ideas of the figures of the 1920s and 1930s who are grouped together and who I write about in that section of my book on geopolitics and the quest for dominance are essentially just voicing the views that you would have found in, you know, many German periodicals of the period, in many the speeches of many German politicians, and indeed in the ideas of revanchists who are naturally wished to both in Germany and in Austria, and in many respects, the Hitlerian regime owes a lot to Austria. It takes a lot of the racial politics of the Balkans and extrapolates them into German policymaking. But, you know, as it were, the idea that Germans, and one got the same view in Hungary, of course, with opposition to the Trianon settlement, that Germans or Hungarians had been unfairly treated by the victors, that there'd been, quote, a victor's peace, and that in a sense there hadn't been justice, racial justice, justice of any form, and that therefore there was a historical need, a moral necessity, a, as it were, whatever phrases, whatever adjectives you want to deploy in conjuncture, but it something had to be done to ensure that Germany, Austria, and Hungary were more prominent at the expense of Slavic neighbors. And this was a racial component, there was a political component, hostility, of course, to communism, and in many senses, hostility to democracy, for example, in the case of Czech democracy. But at any rate, a view that change had to be made, and this change dates from and derives not from the writings of geopoliticians. You might say it derives immediately from the period of post-war settlement, when you have not just violence in areas like Upper Silesia, but also you, or the Burgenland, you have also plebiscites in areas like that, in order to try and produce a political territorialization linked to a what is assumed to be an ethnically derived vote on where particular areas are to go. And of course, this is also a period of violence, often extreme violence linked in Germany in particular to the Freikorps. But you see the same things in Italy, you see the same thing in Hungary, you see the same thing across most of Eastern Europe. And given that that is the case, it is scarcely surprising that people come through with an account of the ethnic coherence and logic of polities and of frontiers, which at one level you might say springs fully formed from the brow of Woodrow Wilson, but you'd be a fool to think that, because there were many, as it were, politicians and commentators who very much took that view when they were looking at nationalism and to frame nationalism. So Haushofer and the others are not, I would argue, actually as instrumental as all that. And of course, one can take it further by arguing that although the Nazis were quite happy to draw on appeared to be the determinism of space and earth that you see in Haushofer and before that in Ratzel, and of course that could be given a racial component as well, and as the French commentators pointed out, German geopolitik was prescriptive rather than analytical. But I think it's worth bearing in mind that Hitler's desire for German revival and strength, and indeed for territorial change, was not simply one in which there was to be simply just a racial component. It was more ambitious than that. There was a determination to have sway over areas where there were no Germans, or very few Germans, and if necessary, to settle Germans indeed to that end. You know, German ideas during World War II, for example, to establish Crimea, which was variously referred to by the Nazis as a German Gibraltar, a German Riviera, or Hitler saw it as the Gossengau, the land of the ancient Goths. Ukraine was to be devoted to SS Latifundia estates. They were to be subjugated peasants, but the idea was to be German farmer proprietors. And Himmler had the idea of a settler colony of ethnic Germans in Ukraine under the name of Hegewald. So there is an idea of ethnic extension towards a much greater Third Reich, but there is also an idea of the Third Reich occupying territory that is no way that of a German people. And of course, it's worth bearing in mind that Haushofer and his son, Albrecht, who'd become a personal advisor to Hess, fell out in a big way with the Third Reich. Albrecht Haushofer angered Ribbentrop, the German foreign minister, in 1938 by arguing that any attack on Czechoslovakia would only unite Britain against Germany, which in a sense was a view that was vindicated in the sense that the British guarantees to Poland and Romania followed the occupation of Bohemia and Moravia in March 1939. Albrecht, even more than Karl, even more than the father, wished to end the war with Berlin in 1940. And Albrecht, who was the professor of geopolitics in the Hochschule für Politik in Berlin, was closely linked to Hess's probably unsanctioned and certainly unsuccessful peace overture to Britain in 1941. And this led to the disgracing of the Haushofers. Haushofer, Albrecht himself went into hiding after the bomb plot of 1944, was captured, imprisoned, and finally shot the following spring in a clearing out of political opponents just before the fall of the Third Reich. Karl was imprisoned at Dachau but survived the war. And dismayed by what had happened to his son, as well as Germany's defeat and his own failure, he and his wife took poison and died in 1946. Now, I mean, I don't think you would find it relatively easy to see Haushofer as the guiding light of Nazi geopolitics. It's true that that was how it was presented. Life magazine in November 1939 presented Karl as, quote, the philosopher of Nazism, and two, the inexhaustible ideas man for Hitler. And Albrecht was depicted looking at a globe. Readers of Life magazine were assured that in, quote, Haushofer's German Academy in Munich, the world is remade every day between breakfast and dinner. The article very much pushed Haushofer to the fore, and It was then used in the film The Nazi Strike of 1942, the American film, which presented Haushofer's Institute in Munich as an account of geopolitics, which was explained as the military control of space. And indeed, in this film, there's a Mackinder sequence. Now, Mackinder's dictum of 1919, who rules East Europe commands the heartland, who rules the heartland commands the world island, i.e. Eurasia to you and me, who rules the world island commands the world. Well, that's taken in the film, 1942 film, as conquer Eastern Europe and you dominate the heartland. Conquer the heartland and you dominate the world island. Conquer the world island and you dominate the world, i.e. threaten America. And this was taken on in the MGM film Man for Destruction of 1943, which was an account of Haushofer. And it depicted him as advising Hitler and coordinating German intelligence gathering around the world. And quote, Haushofer is seen as making, you know, presenting a master plan to dominate the heartland. Or you can go on. I mean, the Americans produced a number of publications during the war in which they translated German geopolitical texts in order to try and explain what the German war policy was. And Robert Strauss-Huppe, in his book, Geopolitics, the Struggle for Space and Power, in 42, wrote, geopolitics is simple and sure, but as disclosed in German writings and policies, it is also illusion, mummery, an apology for theft. Scientific geography deepens the understanding, but like history or chemistry, it has no ready-made formulas for national salvation. So I think one can fairly say that just as if you look at the Goebbels diary, you would get the idea that Goebbels said something and Hitler said, oh, you're brilliant, let's do this. Whereas in fact, Goebbels was far less consequential than in the pages of his diary, and certainly far less consequential for Hitler's major preoccupations during the war, which was operational matters on the Eastern Front. So I think one can find the same on the pre-war argument. I mean, certainly the wartime argument, it's not credible to say that these geopoliticians had influence. But even in the pre-war period, I think if you're looking at Hitler's changes of policy as he tries to manipulate, use, profit by the international interrelations of Britain, the Soviet Union, Italy, Poland, France, Japan, is one in which I don't think you could argue that geopolitics plays a profound role. Now, I next want to look at America, but I wonder, Graham, if you've got any particular questions or comments on that section.
Well, yes, I have. Thank you, Professor Black. I just want to be clear about Haushofer. It's very striking from what you say that in many ways he was an intellectual adornment rather than someone who actually was a master planner. And if you understood Haushofer, you understood what Hitler was going to do next. Can you detect any area where his thinking had an influence on Nazi foreign and military policy?
Well, that's a good question. I think the way it works, and I've often thought this, I've often thought that intellectuals exaggerate their own significance. I think they tend to be read or cited when they say what, as it were, the people running the system wish to hear. If they don't wish to hear it, they're just out there producing stuff, or as it were. I mean, I remember a French academic saying to me, you know, the previous time I'd met him, he had been at Mulhouse, and then the next time I met him, he had a much better post. And I asked him what had happened, and he said, oh, well, you know, he said the right thing as far as the ministry was concerned. It's not that he persuaded the ministry, he knew what to say. And I think that one's got to be very cautious of assuming that Hitler or Goering or Himmler were dependent on commentators, whether you wish to call them intellectuals or not. I mean, Himmler certainly liked having you know, what he thought of as a branch of intellectualism within the SS, particularly in subjects like archaeology, for example. But I don't actually think one would be doing very much by way of understanding Himmler if you thought that he was particularly determined by this group. So no, I'm quite wary of that way of looking at things. I mean, to me, what is interesting is precise, and I have the same view on strategy, is precisely loose concepts that are used because they are very plastic. And I think that is why terms like strategy or geopolitics, or, you know, we're talking today on the day that the Prime Minister announced that he was not pursuing the northern leg of HS2. And last week, I had a group of friends round for a drink, and unfortunately, one of them rather spoilt it by bringing out HS2. And one of the other ones then said, you know, this was an intelligent man. He said, we need to finish it. And I said, well, look, need is a value term. What you mean is you want to finish it, and you're looking for language and ideas to vindicate your intuited notion. And I would say the same thing is true in political terms.
And the idea of Lebensraum, you made clear there was a distinction between Nazi ideas about uniting race together, but also Nazis' ideas of conquest went far beyond that, and giving space to Germans to have a kind of colonial empire. How tied in is that with the idea of having a strategic buffer? So almost in the same way that the French, after the First World War, felt, you know, it was very important that the Rhineland was demilitarized because they felt they needed the security of that strategic buffer. Does that play into German thinking? And did Haushofer have anything particularly in his mind about the idea of strategic buffers?
Now, I don't think strategic buffers would be what I would see. First of all, Haushofer is interested in what he called pan regions. So he praised Mackinder, but he has a variant on it. He has three leading pan regions: pan Europa, pan Asian, and pan America. And each of these is an extension into the southern hemisphere of what he sees as a natural and desirable sphere of influence in the northern. So Pan-Asian is designated for Germany's ally Japan. Germany's region Pan-Europa includes expansion into Russia, but also southwards. And Pan-America is the United States having control, again, a kind of ethnic view here, of South America. Now, that's not a notion of buffer zones, nor is, for example, Hitler's idea eventual dominance in Europe, and particularly Eastern Europe. I mean, he sees, for example, to the east, Siberia as a kind of rump state for those who are deemed undesirable, appropriate neither for Germanization nor extermination. But that's not a sort of buffer against Japan. It's a sort of dumping zone. I would, you know, there's no sort of concept of a buffer, for example, as far as his racial hatred of Jews is concerned. He just wants to kill them all. And in terms of naval policy, his intent, as you may know, under a number of plans, ultimately Plan Z, of building a substantial navy, including aircraft carriers, which are going to ensure that far from being a buffer, the Atlantic is a base for Germany to be able to act against the United States and to operate into South America. And the German naval staff have plans on top of that for establishing bases. They're interested in the Cape Verde Islands, the Canaries, the Azores, which will enable them to maintain a stronger position in the mid-Atlantic. So I don't see Nazi plans as based on some sort of buffer zone principle. I see it as expansionism without limit.
Well, let's cross the Atlantic and look at the American perspective on geopolitics in this period.
Yes, well, I'm not sure how much time I've got for here. So, what I'm going to do is to start us off, and I think we'll continue that in the next in the next one. Let's start off with obviously the founding fathers, who so-called who had and offered a number of geopolitical ideas. Washington in the Farewell Address, for example, Jefferson in a number of his texts, Monroe in his so-called Doctrine of 1823. And I would say that if you're looking at American geopolitics in the early stages, it includes, on the whole, an idea of a wished for disengagement from the corrupt politics of the of Europe, and both in ethos and content, a desire for territorial expansionism in North America, a determination to see the European powers as weak as possible in the American hemisphere, and a wish that American trade should be free of European controls. All of these have been sometimes referred to as an isolationist tradition. They're not an isolationist tradition. I mean, I think if you were a Creek Indian, for example, a Creek Native American, I should say, or if you lived in Canada or Florida, as subjects of Britain and Spain, respectively, the last thing you would have said was that America was an isolationist power. But what I do think is that these provide a set of assumptions, which are in part molded as well by the desire to have a small standing army and navy and a relatively weak state, both of those being products of the defeat politically in the early 20, sorry, the early 19th century of the Federalists, who in crude terms are more interested in big power relationships, by Jefferson's Democratic Republicans, which is also the background for the politics of his successors, Madison and Monroe. So I think there's a, as it were, a long brew here. But the problem for this long brew in the 20th century is the United States, of course, is very far from keeping Europe at a distance. Indeed, it plays a direct role in World War I as a combatant from 1917, World War II from 1941, and the Cold War, or the second stage of the Cold War, the first stage of the Cold War, the one between the two world wars. It's actually Britain who's the principal against the Soviet Union, but in the second stage, it's the United States. And to a great extent, American geopolitics draws in its public manifestations, and I don't mean that in a critical sense, because America is a public politics, particularly in the sense of Congress. It draws on its public manifestations from a sense of fear and anxiety. That is what are the basic motivating geopolitical factors. I mean, if you want to look at geopolitical texts, if you're an intellectual historian, you might look at George Kennan, for example, State Department, and his writing in the late 1940s, but you might just as well possibly be better advised to look at the response to the Zimmermann Telegram and anxieties about German-backed Mexican revanchism in 1917. And I'm starting, I start, I was talking about Germany with reference to Life magazine. Let me look at another one, which tends to be forgotten now because it's not as famous as Life or Time, and that's Fortune. Fortune, which was another illustrated monthly, in March 1943, produced a map. I'm interested in maps, by Richard Eads Harrison, fantastic maps, map maker, very good aerial viewpoints, very good and imaginative projections and perspectives, and he produced a map called One World, One War, and the text goes as follows, quote, "If Japan and Germany are allowed to join hands in India, the Axis will have the advantage of the inner line on a world scale. uninterrupted Axis control of Eurasia's huge masses from Le Havre to Shanghai would transform the New World into an island and the two surrounding oceans into highways of invasion. Now, you can agree or disagree about that. I mean, it doesn't really deal with the practicalities of, well, actually, what was going to be the lift that would allow the Wehrmacht in large numbers to invade the United States, or would provide the logistical support for a significant Japanese army arriving in California. We can, you know, there were practicalities there, but geopolitical statements don't tend to be made in terms of practicality. You only just need to listen to the people who spray the word around like shrapnel today. But what is interesting is that Harrison's text and Harrison's map very much is an explicit, like I would say most geopolitical texts and maps, are arguing for a particular case. It supports the interventionism that is then central to American policy under the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration. Now, what it does is argue that apparently the fate of India, in other words, part of the British Empire, which traditionally Americans were not very particularly sympathetic on British rule of, and actually Roosevelt wasn't, that the fate of India would determine whether Japan and Germany could invade America. Well, I don't think so, but that was the argument. Liberal interventionism, in other words, for Harrison and others, rested on defense in response to a set of sense of threat, and the way to have this defense is to be active. So in other words, instead of being just what was known as hemispheric defense, which was the geopolitical term for the isolationist viewpoint in the late 30s, we will just defend our hemisphere, and indeed we will create weapon systems like aircraft, which are designed with a range accordingly. This was to be turned on its head by the idea that defense can only be operative if you control in practice much of the world, and certainly can do down your opponents across the world. So what you've got here is a tension within American understandings of America's position in the world, a long-standing one, a one that you can see, as I've indicated, right back to the founding fathers, and one that proceeds in a way where we are in World War II, because this pulse to external action had been seen certainly from the 1890s. I think it's fair to say that that the reality earlier on is that although America had had warships in the Mediterranean against the Barbary pirates and had sent, you know, ships to so-called open up Japan and to star in the plot of Madame Butterfly, although that is the case, America's principal geopolitical concerns across the political spectrum in the 19th century were very much located in near America, vis-a-vis Native Americans, vis-a-vis Britain, Spain, and France, and with a minor extent, Russia, as far as Alaska was concerned. This helped to ensure that, in fact, America could wage a bitter civil war in 1861-5 without it spilling over as had appeared possible, because ultimately foreign powers were less troubled by America than America was troubled by foreign powers, in the sense that you know, the Americans were fearful of British or French intervention in the Civil War, but the British and French were less motivated by having America as their central concern in foreign policy. Now, in the 1890s, this changes, partly because of domestic political ideas and interests. It's been argued by Edward Rhodes, for example, that the building up of a significant ocean-going fleet reflected particular East Coast industrial and political interests, particularly in Pennsylvania and New York. It's certainly the case that the American war with Spain in 1898, and Spain did not pose a threat to the United States, was something that both reflected opportunity and possibility. The two were linked through the notion of capability. The Americans could do it. It was possible, and therefore it became an opportunity. Indeed, the war with Spain was a culmination as it rose over Cuba, which is an island of long-standing American interest, and the Caribbean was an area of a long-standing American interest. But at the same time, it's worth pointing out that the Americans did not necessarily extend empire to the same extent as other powers. For example, yes, they annexed the Philippines and Puerto Rico, but not Cuba. And their major concern in East Asia, notably China, Korea, and Japan, was to try and extend their trade, their political and economic interests, as well as some cultural ones, particularly Christian missionary activity in both China and Korea. And I think it's worth saying that this emphasizes the way that when one's looking at geopolitics, one has to accept that there are a range of meanings that term can do. Now, what I want to do is just take us into World War One, and then we're going to pause and go continue the next one. So from the 1890s, the American naval drive acquired a mass of its own, irrespective of any particular political requirements, whether phrased as geopolitical or not. So, for example, by 1910, America had the second largest number of capital ships in the world, following Britain, but ahead of Germany, let alone France. And what the point of this was completely unclear. Britain wasn't a threat to the United States at that period. In fact, the British had been very cautious in the Venezuela, in the recent Venezuela crisis. It's not exactly apparent what the cause of this was, nor what the logic of it was in terms of where it would allow America to go. America could use its naval dominance to sail around the Caribbean and sail across the Pacific, but to what end? Indeed, I think it's fair to say that American geopolitics was to be started anew in 1917 by the need to react to what was a German unilateral navalism that was aimed not against America, but against Britain in the shape of an attempt to knock out British trade and therefore starve Britain to surrender. So it's only if you assume that the survival of Britain was a key American geopolitical goal that you can make a logic of this. And you might well argue that. But this point underlines the difficulty of relating, let alone aligning, force development, strategy, policy, and geopolitics. And it's worth bearing in mind that if you look just most specifically on the force structure of the American Navy in 1917 to 18, it was overly focused on capital ships, which were jolly good things to give the Philadelphia shipyard to build, as well as the upper shipyards, which looked good, but which are not very useful for anti-submarine capabilities. But then again, it's very unclear how you are to determine what you need. And as I've indicated, it's not apparent necessarily who your opponent is going to be, and therefore what your procurement should be and force structure should be in terms of reacting to them. So geopolitics, far from being deterministic, and as I indicated in our very first discussion, far from geography being destiny, the practicality is most people hadn't got the faintest idea what was going to happen, although they generally had very clear views on the matter. Graham.
That's a very potent note to end on. We are actually out of time, but we will continue with this, the developing role and interest of geopolitics with America in the next episode. But Professor Black, for talking us through that, and also the role of Haushofer and German Nazi thinking, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.